You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Thursday, August 19th, 2010, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Yeah, huh?
And Evan Bernstein.
Hi, everyone. This day, 2007. Perry DeAngelis, succumbed to his long battle with scleroderma.
He is a skeptic of great note.
Thank you. Very, very well put. He is gone, yet he will never be forgotten.
That's only been 3 years.
It seems like a lot longer to me.
Yeah, in some ways it seems like a lot longer.
Yeah.
We miss you, Perry. We talk about Perry every time we get together. His name comes up.
It does.
Yeah.
We just had so much in common, you know, with him. Obviously, it was obviously the skepticism, but so many other things. Really, really big part of all of our lives. Huge part.
He was one hell of a funny bastard, too.
Right now, he's sitting in limbo saying, get on with the show, guys.
Like, oh, guys.
Isn't that where atheists go?
Limbo? Is that where we go?
I thought we went to Oblivion.
Isn't that the new patch for WoW?
Oblivion.
Dork.
Let's move on to some news items. The first news item is about banning Wi-Fi in schools in Canada. I tell you, those Canadians.
Well, that's 10 emails we're going to get right there. Angry.
So some parents in Canada are trying to get wireless internet turned off in the schools before their kids return to classes next month. When I read this article, I couldn't believe it. They're claiming that the Wi-Fi signals can make their kids sick. They're claiming illnesses experienced by their children are brought on, and here's the list, dizziness, headaches, nausea, heart problems, memory loss, trouble concentrating, skin rashes, hyperactivity, night sweats, and insomnia. If you look at this list, as I went through it again, I'm like, okay, dizziness and headaches and nausea are like, I don't want to say they're irrelevant, but, you know.
Nonspecific is the word you're looking
there,
for.
Thank you, Steve.
Vague.
Nonspecific. Yeah. The heart problems they talked about were a fast heartbeat or a racing heartbeat. Memory loss, trouble concentrating, skin rashes, hyperactivity, night sweats, insomnia. You know, they're not coming out with cancer or something specific. They're coming out with, like as Steve said, all these non-specific symptoms. The parents are claiming their kids' symptoms go away on the weekends when school isn't in session. And there's a guy named Rodney Palmer who represents the Simcoe County Safe School Committee. And he claimed that, and I quote, the kids are getting sick at school, but not at home. I'm not saying it's because of the Wi-Fi, because we don't know yet, but I've pretty much eliminated every other possible source. So, Rodney, yes, indeed, you are saying it's Wi-Fi if you've eliminated every other possible source.
What about the source of, I don't want to go to school today? Because, I mean, when I was in school, there were plenty of weeks where I would be sick from Monday to Friday and then miraculously cured on the weekend.
I used to say I was allergic to typewriter ribbon. It'd break out in a rash and I couldn't get near any typewriters within 200 feet. They were all over
the school.
What's
a typewriter?
So. I'm just putting it in proper perspective of, you know, the context of time. And
I used to get
your
telegraph
age.
Sickness.
Exactly.
Mimeograph machine.
I got you all beat, guys. I would, one time I got a can of soup and I threw it in the toilet and pretended I threw up. And my mom completely bought it.
Next time, open the can.
And another time, I told her that I my leg was hurt and I actually let her take me to the doctor.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh wow.
Would you rather been at school?
But we're not saying this is all due to kids not wanting to go to school.
No, it was definitely early Wi-Fi. It was the testing of Wi-Fi that got my knee.
But no, I mean just these symptoms. It also could just be that kids are sleep deprived, you know, and they're not having these symptoms on the weekend because they're sleeping in on the weekend. They don't have to get up early for an early class. Kids are staying up late playing video games. They're sleep deprived in the morning and when they have to go to class. That may account for a portion of this. It's also, these are just common symptoms of stress or anxiety. And, people will latch on to the available diagnosis that's popular in the culture at the moment. If their parents are saying, is it the Wi-Fi? Could it be the Wi-Fi? That's what the kids are going to latch on to.
Right. And, I mean, isn't there this idea of there being like a sort of like a mass delusion, but to a much lesser extent.
Sure.
Where, yeah, I mean, everybody's getting sick.
No, it's a mass delusion. It fits the definition of a mass delusion. If you, and the experiments have been done, like if you tell people in an office building, oh, there's something in the air and people are getting asthma-like symptoms, people will start coming forward saying, yeah, I got those symptoms. You know, part of it is some people that, you know, the symptoms were there before and now they're just, again, they're latching on to what's available. But also people will just come up with psychosomatic symptoms. That's just the nature of human psychology.
I have a couple of points I want to make. One, the other thing that concerns me about this, anytime people say, you know, this is the cause, what if it is something? What if there is asbestos in the school? What if one of the kids actually has a legitimate reason why that he or she has a headache that needs medical attention, and they're saying it's Wi-Fi, right? The other thing is, these symptoms that they're coming up with, like they say that the kid has hyperactivity or night sweats and insomnia, these are other symptoms that are actually serious by themselves. And if you go to the doctor and the doctor does an examination on them and says that he doesn't find anything, what do you think is actually happening? Do you think the kid's lying about it, or do you actually think that there could be something else in play?
There's a number of possibilities. You know, first of all, we can't always diagnose everything, right? So people may have a viral infection and causing symptoms like this. There are things you can't disprove that could cause a lot of these symptoms. Kids could be coming down with their first presentation of migraine that can cause a lot of these symptoms. And again, there'd be no way to prove or disprove it. So, you know, there's the symptoms of life, the common ailments, the nonspecific symptoms, symptoms of stress, symptoms of sleep disorder, maybe a little bit of malingering, you know, the kids who don't want to go to school, all thrown together. But if you go out looking for these kinds of symptoms, because, you know, the confirmation bias kicks in, right? You think, oh, are kids suffering from Wi-Fi? That's where the mass delusion then comes in. This just all becomes confirmation bias. So, again, how do you know if it's real or not? You have to do some kind of controlled or blinded evaluations. Now, so-called electromagnetic hypersensitivity has been studied. Whenever people who believe that they get all these dramatic symptoms in the presence of Wi-Fi or electromagnetic fields are tested in a blinded situation, they cannot tell when they are or are not being exposed to EMF. So it doesn't exist as a phenomenon if it disappears under blinded conditions.
Let's say that someone was exposed to an enormous amount of microwave radiation. Would these be the types of symptoms that someone would experience? You know, I'd like to know what actual symptoms would be if someone was getting too much radiation.
I think you'd experience a mild cooked feeling.
Yeah, right. Depends on the exact frequency, but what you're getting to, so little bit is like, what's the plausibility here? You know, what could the levels of radiation that are being produced by Wi-Fi produce any biological effects? So there's one effect from electromagnetic fields is so-called ionization. And this is, you know, ionizing radiation. You get this, this is totally dependent on the amount of energy that's in the electromagnetic fields, and that's dependent upon the frequency. So at the ultraviolet level and above, that's ionizing radiation. Below ultraviolet, so the visible spectrum and below infrared microwaves, that's non-ionizing radiation. And that what that means is, you know, ionizing means it has enough energy to actually alter chemical bonds. So we can alter a DNA molecule or a protein or whatever, or a cell wall. It can alter a chemical bond.
Basically, electrons and molecules are being just blasted apart, really,
in a sense. It could break a bond. Non-ionizing radiation does not have enough energy to break chemical bonds, so it doesn't cause ionization. So what can a non-ionizing radiation do? And that's what we're talking about here with either cell phones or Wi-Fi, et cetera. And there, the primary effect would be that it could still transfer heat. And it could be, you know, transferring heat to tissue that could be having biological effects. But if you calculate how much energy is in the Wi-Fi, it's actually fairly insignificant, the amount of heating that it could even potentially cause, which is also dependent on things like coupling, you know. But even if you assume a complete energy transfer, it still is very, very low amount of energy, and the heating would be insignificant. So then the question is, well, if it's not ionization and heating is insignificant, is there any other plausible biological effects that it could be having? And there, the answer is nothing proven. There's ideas about what might be going on, but there, you know, none of them have really been demonstrated. And the ones that have been studied, the results are basically negative, showing that there is no measurable effect. Some studies have come up with a positive effect, but they can all be explained just on the basis of heating, you know, depending on how you set up your experiment. But if you remove the notion that a little bit of heat is also being transferred to the cells that you're studying, for example, all these other effects are not demonstrated. So there really is extremely low plausibility. We can also look at it in terms of just the amount of energy. So cell phones typically have about 100 times the EMF as Wi-Fi does. And we've talked about cell phones before. The risk of cell phones is extremely low, to the point where we haven't ruled it out for long-term exposure. There really is no evidence for any health effects from cell phones for less than 10 to 15 years of constant use. So Wi-Fi has 100 times less energy than what you're getting exposed to in the cell phone. And the cell phones are typically held right up to your head where, you know, the Wi-Fi is at a greater distance. So plausibility there is extremely low. In fact, the radiation from the Wi-Fi is not really significantly different than just background radiation.
Do you think a television set or a computer monitor throws off more radiation than Wi-Fi?
Yeah, I mean, if you're walking around in a modern home with electronics, you know, you're getting more EMF than the Wi-Fi, yeah.
So maybe if it were put into that context, I think that might quell a lot of these hysterical people.
No, you're giving them far too much credit. And there's some people behind this that are like dedicated anti-Wi-Fi or EMF activists who are driving this. Like this one woman, Magda Havas. Check out her website, and you'll see that this is a long-term dedicated topic. You know, this is not just, hey, maybe it's the Wi-Fi, you know. So this is not going away anytime soon. This is going to be this is fluoridation in the water. You know, this is going to be another topic where there's going to be a subculture of conspiracy theorists who think it's causing all these problems, and they'll last for years, always be there in the background.
They'll write a book about it.
Yeah, they'll have a website, write a book about it.
Man, wouldn't it suck if Wi-Fi did have negative health effects, though?
Sure, of course it would. It's very convenient, but I'm not worried about it.
I have to move my uranium paperweight here. Good. All set.
Is it enriched uranium?
Of course.
What if it was just poor?
Enriched uranium.
Yeah, you know, there's not that much radiation, just uranium ore.
All right, so bottom line is there will be no banning of Wi-Fi. Cut the crap right now. Thank you.
In a rational world. I mean, so far, the school boards are holding fast, although there was one university in Canada that did ban Wi-Fi. So, you know, it can happen. But I would be pissed if I couldn't have Wi-Fi where I worked because of this kind of hysteria. That would be inconvenient. Rebecca, tell us about the Australian psychic who found the wrong body.
Yeah, well, all right, so a few weeks ago, there was a 6-year-old girl who disappeared from her home in Sydney, Australia. And there's been a big search on for her, and one person thought she could help. She's an Aboriginal elder named Cheryl Carol Loggerway, and she claimed she had a dream that told her that the girl's body would be found at, probably mispronounce this, but the Nurragingi Reserve in Western Sydney. So she and a friend went searching through the reserve, and they didn't find the girl's body, but they did stumble upon the torso of an adult woman. So just a torso with the head and the arms and the legs cut off and wrapped up in plastic, which is obviously pretty horrific. And so the news reported this as psychic finds wrong dead body, which implies a number of things. One of which it implies that this woman is a psychic, but it's not, she's not. She specifically has said that she's not a psychic. She said that she had a hunch, basically, that she had this dream, and so she just thought she would go searching. But, you know, that's not a good story for the media. So they'd rather pretend that this woman is a psychic. And then there's this idea that she used her psychic powers to somehow hone in on some dead body, just not the right dead body, which is a version of a sharpshooter's fallacy where, you know, you shoot the side of a barn door and then you draw the target around where you shot. And it's, congratulations. So if we were to judge her accuracy just based on did she or did she not find the body that she set out to find, well, then no, she did not. She failed. But if we redefine it to say, well, did she find somebody? Then yes, she did. But that's not really the point of being a psychic, I think. Or at least being a psychic with any kind of specific and useful power. So basically what you've got here is, a woman who set out to find a dead body and found one, not using psychic powers, but most likely because she was familiar with the landscape. She, you know, she was trying to find a dead body, so she went to a place where she thought that dead bodies might be stashed. Apparently this place is pretty prime territory for,
right,
for disposing of dead bodies. It's that kind of, vacated place with a lot of underbrush where you could stash a body.
Yeah, so either she's retrodicting a little bit there. That's one possibility. Or she was looking for a body in a place where you might find one and did find one. It just wasn't the one that was in the news media at that week. Or she has some connection to that case. You know, right? If I were, you know, a police officer working that case, I'm sure. And the interviews with the police make them seem pretty savvy. Like, they're not buying this whole psychic thing, you know? So they're probably checking out that angle. I guess they would probably routinely, if you just happen to stumble across the location of a body, that probably instantly makes you a person of interest, and at least they'll clear you to some degree. Because otherwise, you know, it's just an alternate hypothesis you have to check out.
Yeah, definitely. The chief inspector said, our quote was, "I have certain strong feelings about people who claim they are psychic. I don't think it will help if we enter a discussion on that." Which to me says, psychics are BS, so drop it. Yeah. I wouldn't really worry about them missing a trick there.
Well, let's talk about Ray Kurzweil and the brain. If you guys read about this.
Ray.
Kurzweil's an interesting character. You know, he certainly is an innovator in terms of certain computer software applications like text recognition, or is it, he does speech recognition, right? Speech to text.
Yeah.
And is a futurist. He's written several books, making predictions about the future. And in a recent talk, he, made the prediction that we will likely reverse engineer the brain within 10 years, by 2020.
10 years.
Which actually differs from his previous predictions. If you've read his earlier books, he was saying, you know, reverse engineering the brain, meaning basically creating a computer model of the brain by something closer to 2030 and
2029,
actually duplicating the process of the brain by maybe closer to 2040. So it seems like he's moving up his timetable a little bit. But the interesting bit is his justification for saying that this is something that we will achieve by 2020.
Because he's afraid he's going to die before then.
That was my thought. He wants it to see it in his lifetime.
That's become a cliche. Futurists always predict that immortality will be achieved by the time they die. But he did a calculation of the amount of information contained in that part of the genome that codes for brain proteins. He said that that amount of information equates to about 1 million lines of code. And you use that as a basis for his prediction that this is something that would be achievable within 10 years, you know, based upon computing power as well as, you know, software development. The problem with that line of reasoning is, there's multiple problems with it, but the core problem is the major premise that the amount of information contained in the brain can be inferred from the amount of information contained in that part of the genome that codes for the brain. We've actually talked about this on the show before, the fact that the genes don't code for the brain. It's not a a blueprint of the brain. It's a list of instructions that, if you follow, makes a brain. But that process actually adds a tremendous amount of extra information. The brain actually holds many orders of magnitude more information than is contained in our genome. And as one example of that, there's something called somatotopic mapping, where the retina maps to the visual cortex, for example, or the motor cortex maps to the muscles in the body, or the sensory cortex maps to the skin of your body, you know. And that the process of developing the brain, so the exactly where each neuron goes is not outlined in the genes. It just says follow this set of instructions. And when you this set of instructions are followed, the neurons become laid out in the somatotopic arrangement, which contains a lot more information than just the set of instructions that went into developing it in the first place.
Yeah, Steve, look at it like this. Picture a seed that grows into a gigantic tree.
Yeah.
The seed holds information to grow the tree, but when the tree is a full-grown tree, the seed didn't know where every leaf was going to be, where every
That's correct, Jay, but it's even worse than that, because you might argue that the location of the leaves are somewhat random, or their location's at least not important. But if you look at it, like the location of neurons as analogous to the location of leaves, it actually is important. Right, the location of the neurons is important and meaningful and contains information, and they're not placed randomly. They're placed as part of an elaborate process of responding to environmental stimulation and the location of other neurons, etc. So your analogy is close, but actually it's a lot more significant for the way the brain develops.
Yeah, I would recommend P.Z. Myers did a great blog entry on this, and he kind of described the genome, the description of the brain in the genome, as basically a collection of molecular tools kind of all wrapped up together and in bits of conditional logic. And the brain really essentially unfolds during development based on cell-to-cell interactions, and there's just no way that you're really going to just glean that from the genome.
You know, again, Kurzweil is an interesting guy who thinks about a lot of interesting topics, and I just think he blew this one. He was out of his depth, or he didn't check himself with somebody who actually knows what they're talking about in terms of the relationship of between genome information and brain information.
Yeah,
this is the problem with people like Kurzweil and, for instance, our guest last week, Aubrey de Grey, which is that they tend to cross disciplines so often, and it takes a different expert in every field to verify or contradict what they're saying. And Aubrey has even said that to me in the past. I asked him how he felt about doing debates, because a lot of skeptics are obviously skeptical of his claims. And his point was that there aren't very many people out there who could debate him, because he goes off into so many different fields. I think Kurzweil's the same way. I think when it comes to computer science and whatnot, he's very knowledgeable. But when he branches out, he kind of gets out of control. But the problem is that people aren't knowledgeable in biology, the biology of the brain, and so they hear someone who's fairly intelligent speak about these things, and they take him seriously, and they just assume that he knows what he's talking about.
And this is another good example of a scientist who does know a lot about something or their specialty, but this happens a lot. They step outside of their comfort zone and start speculating about other things. But they think, well, I'm a scientist, so I can comment on this other stuff because I'm intelligent, and they totally miss it.
I'll put a different point on it, too, because that could happen even within your area of expertise, just less likely. But the real difference, as I see it, or one really fundamental difference, and I see this as a difference between cranks and legitimate scientists all the time, is that legitimate science is a community endeavor. It's you are putting ideas out there to the scientific community, and then those ideas get picked over and criticized, and you have to deal with the pushback and that criticism. by either accounting for it in some way or altering your ideas, or someone else comes up with an idea and you incorporate that and they're incorporating your ideas. It really is the sort of intellectual community effort, whereas cranks tend to be all out there all by themselves. You know, they're just talking to themselves, developing their own ideas. They're not checking it with other experts. If they're going into other fields, they're not checking what they're thinking with experts in those other fields. They're not having a conversation. They're just going off into fantasy land. Bob, tell us about magnetars and black holes.
This is an interesting bit of astronomical news, not only for the science, though, but some of the various news outlets kind of presented it was kind of interesting to me. Some were saying that this was a new mystery about black hole formation, and others were saying that a mystery has been solved, so it was kind of interesting. But a study led by Dr. Ben Ritchie of Open University recently describes a very special type of neutron star called a magnetar, which is short for magnetic star. I guess that's kind of obvious. But conventional wisdom holds that when a star of 10 to 25 solar masses collapses at the end of its life after a supernova, the result is what is called a neutron star. Now this is pretty cool. What's going on here? What they think is going on? You got all this infalling matter that's left over. It actually compresses, squishes all the electrons and protons together, forming more and more neutrons. So basically you've got neutrons, protons, and electrons, but the electrons and protons are joining together to form more neutrons. So it's basically just a big ball of neutrons eventually. Now, the process stops due to something called neutron degeneracy. And all that really means is that once you have this ball of energetic neutrons and nothing, there's no protons left, there's no electrons left, it's kind of like a wall that stops gravity from causing any more collapse. And then it becomes stable, and then you have your neutron star. Now, if you had any more mass, even this neutron degeneracy can't stop it, and you would end up with a black hole at that point. So now we have a neutron star, and since these are, you know, essentially pure nuclear matter, they're so dense, everyone has to say in all their articles about neutron stars that a thimbleful would weigh on the order of millions of tons.
Of course, you could never have a thimbleful.
Right.
Why is that? Why would you say that?
Because you need all of that mass in order to compress it down. It would explode if
right.
you tried
all right,
to
so
remove.
It's not just the nature of that material. It is by the compression.
It is, yes, exactly.
Right. But once in a while, neutron stars also have an incredibly powerful magnetic field around them. Now, this is what a magnetar is. It's a special, very rare type of neutron star. These magnetars can have magnetic fields that are gigateslas, billions of teslas, which is quadrillions of times more powerful than Earth's geomagnetic field, which is only about 30 to 60 microteslas. So, I mean, these are just gargantuan magnetic fields that these things have. Now, these fields are so strong, they could actually kill you if you were just 1,000 kilometers away. The water in the human body is diamagnetic, meaning that it creates its own magnetic field in opposition to an externally applied magnetic field. So these battling fields then would just basically just tear your body apart rather efficiently, I would think.
So it's stronger than Wi-Fi is what you're saying.
Right. Just a little. So what astronomers discovered then was a magnetar in Westerland 1 star cluster in the Milky Way, about 16,000 light years from Earth, but to the left over there. This magnetar was pretty odd because it apparently formed from a parent star that had 40 solar masses. So how then could it become a magnetar and not a black hole? Because you're way above the accepted range of 10 to 25. So why didn't it become a black hole? And this was this is the mystery. Something was wrong about our theories about either black hole formation or maybe our ideas about stellar evolution. And it looks like this latest research is telling us that the latter is the answer. Dr. Ben Ritchie and his colleagues claim that this magnetar had a companion star, meaning that it was in a binary star system. This other star then likely siphoned off the mass of this big star enough until it weighed enough to become a neutron class star instead of a black hole. So over the course of its life, this companion star just kind of just sucked away all the mass or most of the mass of this massive star until it was just under probably the threshold where it could become a neutron star, and that's what it became. So then the takeaway here is that it looks like binary star systems can play a very significant role in stellar evolution, and I thought you might like to know that.
Interesting.
That's fascinating.
Well, Evan, tell us about last week's Who's That Noisy?
Last week's Who's That Noisy was as follows.
Okay.
All I know right. what that is, actually.
Really?
That's my grandparents having sex.
Oh. That was good. They still have sex?
That's
funny in so many different ways. That's fun for the whole family right there.
So what is it, Evan?
That is the scalloped spiny lobster.
Oh, I knew that.
Scalloped spiny lobster.
Well, what's he doing? What's he doing?
Defending himself, defending his territory.
Did anyone guess that, Evan?
No, nobody got. They guessed Ooh. Some sorts of fish, bugs.
Is that 2 weeks in a row that you have stumped everyone?
Well, Evil Eye actually supplied the week prior.
But still.
The noisy. But yes, 2 weeks in a row. In
well
which
done.
No, nobody was able to figure out who that noisy is.
So
maybe
going to try to make it three for three this week.
So here we go.
Fair enough. But where then is the missing link between apes and this Darwinius Masoli? Answer me that, Professor.
There you go. That is this week's Who's That Noisy. Got right to it.
Well, thank you, Evan.
All right. Good luck, everyone. Thank you.
Well, let's go on with our interview. We're sitting here at TAM 8 with Bruce Hood, author of Super Sense. Bruce, welcome back to The Skeptic's Guide.
Hi.
And I have to say, I watched your talk today, and I love the material, by the way. I love the talk. The kind of stuff that you deal with really is, in my opinion, at the absolute core of skepticism, which is the knowledge about how our brains function, how they filter information and deal with, you know, the world around us. So give us a little flavor of your talk today and tell us, like, what are those things that you've learned in your career that really that you feel are most relevant to what we do as skeptics?
Okay, so really the talk was trying to draw people's attention to the basic function of a brain, which is to interpret the world and make sense of it and to build models, if you like. It allows you to make predictions, figure out why things are the way they are. It's like a causal inference mechanism. And it's usually pretty good. It's done as well for all these millions of years, but it has a few built-in flaws. And sometimes it makes errors. And those errors, I think, could underpin a lot of supernatural beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
The assumption that there are hidden forces or dimensions or things operating which can't be explained by science.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think one of the critical points I was making in the demonstrations throughout the talk was showing how people shouldn't even trust their own senses. Because mm-hmm. you know the phrase, seeing is believing? Well, I hopefully demonstrate today that that's not the case.
Right. Believing is seeing in many cases.
Indeed. Yeah. So that's an example where your models of the world really color the way that you interpret the world. And the late Richard Gregory was a great friend of mine. He said this 50 years ago, that you need these models of the world to interpret it. And that, of course, sort of constrains the sorts of things that you pay attention to.
Mm-hmm.
So believing very much is seeing. It's a way that you go out and, you know, sample information
yeah.
to fit. And part of that process, you know, occasionally produces these explanations
mm-hmm.
which don't really hold up under the scrutiny of evidence.
Right. You said one word during your talk that caught my attention, which I thought was, for me, a core concept. You didn't focus on it, but I knew what you were saying. And you said that our perception of the world is a constructive
mm-hmm.
process.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a deceptively deep little concept
Indeed.
You threw in there in the middle of your talk.
Yeah.
It's not something that we passively
yeah.
are perceiving. We're constructing it with
yeah.
tons of assumptions. Can you
yeah.
elaborate that a little bit?
You don't have any privileged direct access
yeah.
to reality. Your brain is always extrapolating on the basis of information that it's receiving, and then it's constructing that into a framework to try and make the best fitting model to what you think mm-hmm. you're seeing. And so one of the very simple visual illusions I talked about are these ones where you think you see a geometric shape, which is basically an illusory subjective contour. Now, the interesting thing about that, it's a very simple demonstration. Everyone sees the illusory shape, but what they may not appreciate is that if you go into the brain, we can find cells which are firing as if that object really was there. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't make the distinction between the fact of reality and the illusion, because the brain, if it's come up with that solution, says, well, there really should be a shape there, so fire as if it really is there. So that was the basic point, that all of our phenomenological experience is really extrapolated, is really constructed from the information. And of course, your models that you apply to interpreting information will allow you to imagine all sorts of things. So when I said someone thinks they've seen a ghost, at the neuronal level, it's really indistinguishable.
Right.
The problem is a lot of people think that they equate the eyes with a movie camera, or the brain with a hard drive filling up with information that it stores that doesn't change over time, all that. And they can't. A lot of people just don't get past that, and they can't relate to the idea that we are constructing what we see. They think it's a window, but it's not. It's a window that that we change and manipulate and deal with.
Yeah, I think if there's one thing I try to get across to non-skeptics is extrapolating from the optical illusion. Everyone knows what an optical illusion is, and it's cool, it's fun, but they don't learn the lesson from that. It's like your whole brain operates that way.
Yes.
Everything you think and remember, it's all constructed in the same flawed way that your visual images are, and they're subject to the same kind of illusions.
Absolutely. I mean, if you can demonstrate that at the very basic, simple level, the system that these flaws are there, then you can imagine that when you're dealing with even more complex sort of representations, then the scope for errors is much more obvious. So that's the whole point, that the whole brain is designed to try and interpret and build models.
Exactly. Now, I think last time you were on the show, we focused a lot on the notion of essence, that we assume that things have an essence, and that goes a long way to giving us our sense that there is a lot of our supernatural beliefs flow from that. I don't know that we talked about a related concept, and you did allude to it earlier just now, which was agency. So something else that we assume is not only that things have an essence, but they're agents operating in the world. And I try to understand the way our brains treat the concept of agency. So help me out. Tell me, give me, if you can summarize your understanding of that, where we are with that.
Yeah, so it would appear to be a system which emerges very early. We know this from the work from Paul Bloom's lab and Karen Wynn. They do work with very young babies. And Val Kummire, in particular, is the lady who has really been doing this work. And they've shown these simple geometric little videos of objects moving around the screen. And what we see them as adults, we see them as being purposeful. They seem to have goals, you know, even though they're just kind of random movements. And with some of their sequences, they look as if they're, you know, playing out some sort of scenario. We're giving them a rich interpretation. So we're seeing them as agents, as having purposes and intents. So agency is really this default that we seem to slip into when we're trying to give a causal explanation for why things are the way they are. You know, if a plate falls off the table, then it had to be caused by something. So agency is, again, a kind of default way of interpreting the presence of something which is causing it.
Right. But it's also my understanding that we do, our brains will make a very hard distinction between things that we think are agents and things that we think are not agents. We sort of, we know that a rock is not an agent, so we categorize it differently in our brains.
That's right.
But that division is not between real agents and non-agents, or things that are alive and that are not alive. It's things that act like agents and that don't act like agents. But that's another way in which we're constructing based upon lots of assumptions, and we get it wrong a lot of times.
Yeah, so Dan Dennett made this point. He called it an intentionality default. And basically, so this is when you kind of treat your computer as being vindictive,
right?
When it crashes on you, or your car as being malevolent because it breaks down on the way to... And he's argued that, you know, we adopt this position as a kind of convenient way of interacting with things which clearly aren't agents. We kind of know this at one level, but at another level, if we treat it as if it did have purpose and goals and intentions, it allows us to kind of interact with it in a meaningful way. That may be the case, but, I certainly know that people seem to lose all rationality when machinery breaks around them. And it does seem as if it was deliberate. And, you know, It just seems. I mean,
guilty
Michael Shermer.
Yeah,
here.
Yeah.
Michael Shermer gave a really great story yesterday. I don't know if you caught this, but he was on the lift shaft and he was using his iPhone, and this lady was exiting the lift, and he gestured to her to leave the lift before him, and the iPhone slipped out of his hand. And it fell into the gap between the lift shaft and the door. And he watched as it rattled down and then disappeared down the shaft. And he stood there with his mouth open watching that. And it was very difficult not to see that as being a vindictive piece of nonsense. He didn't see
right.
it. Yeah, it was like this thing just escaped. And right, that's right. just our tendency to see things as being purposeful and
wow.
doing things to be.
Do you hold with those who say that this tendency to seek agency is all leads to things like conspiracy thinking and even religious beliefs about there being a God, for example?
Oh, sure. I mean, yeah. I mean, it can operate in any sphere where you're trying to apply some causal mechanism, some causal – why did things happen? Well, someone did it. Someone was responsible. The trouble with that, of course, is you get into an infinite regress of causes, you know, because it's very difficult – you know, to even conceive random events. You know, the brain can't conceive randomness. If I asked you to, you know, press on your keyboard ones and zeros and try and create a random pattern, very soon you'd just fall into a sequence. You know, if I take coffee beans and I throw them on the table, you can't see them as random. You already automatically organize them into some pattern. And I think that's the same with sequences of events. You see them as being a chain of, you know, agency.
Right. And conspiracy thinking as well. I mean, that's something
exactly.
that we talk about a lot. And it seems like there's this inherent sense of the invisible hand operating behind events.
Yeah. The notion that it might just be a kind of coincidence is something that we just don't readily accept. Coincidence. Mm-hmm. We're not really good at our statistical reasoning. The brain was never really designed to do that. You know, we're not Bayesians. We can't do probability analysis.
It's not intuitive at all.
It's not intuitive. And that's why, you know, statistics is really difficult for people to accept.
Yeah, we suck at probability.
Yeah, probability. You know, there's all these beautiful examples of illusions of probability, and people just never get it. Nope. You know?
This is a little off what you typically talk about, at least as far as I'm aware, but I'm interested in what your thinking is about evolutionary psychology. So do you involve yourself at all in asking that deeper question about why our brains evolved to be the way they are, or you think it's just not an answerable question or not interesting?
Well, I think the problem with the evolutionary psychology is it's often disregarded as a just-so story because it's very difficult to look back into the, you know, to the mists of early civilization, early man, to figure out why we have evolved our behaviors and our thought patterns. But, you know, I believe the mind is a product of the brain, and the brain is a physical system, a biological system, which evolved under selective pressure. So ultimately, I would have to contend that a lot of it is constrained by evolutionary pressure. The difference, of course, is when culture comes in, and then the degrees of freedom, to give an engineering term, become huge. You can't really, you know, figure out exactly what the causal chain of events was, which led to our predispositions to think or behave in certain ways. So I suppose what I'm saying is that clearly, I think that evolutionary psychology must be true to some extent, but to apply it as an explanatory framework to make sense of modern day behaviors is difficult. And it leads to a lot of simplistic notions, naivety, you know, men being more aggressive and wanting to have sex with more women. These are typical things which are said, this has obviously had an evolutionary adaptation. But again, that's really hard to say in a scientific sort of way.
Yeah, so you kind of have to assume a hyper-adaptationalist position, which is not tenable in order to be an evolutionary psychologist. So, because culture and just randomness and behavior is meant to be so diverse and adaptive that you can't say A led to B.
We weren't around at the time that the various gene was selected. And so we just have to kind of make a after the effect kind of analysis. And that can be obviously driven by your own expectations and models of what you think was happening, but we don't know for certainty.
Right.
So evolutionary psychology, I think it's useful because it gets you to kind of think about, you know, if there's something there, why would it, you know, what possibly could have had done. But then you definitely need to have other lines of evidence. You know, maybe it's genetic or maybe it's something to do with anthropology, but you'd have to have more than one line of evidence rather than an argument based on an evolutionary perspective. That's my opinion.
It's complex.
It's complex and it's after the fact.
Can I ask, you know, what your experience has been as an academic with the degree to which you've been popularizing your research in science?
Yeah, I've reached a sort of crossroads. Well, I think I've already set down the path, actually. Now it's no longer a crossroads. I've been doing this now for 2 years. And I think that I'm transforming somewhat from your mainstream kind of academic to someone who's increasingly spending more time talking to the general public. And I used to have some real reservations about that because for many, many years it was felt that that was somehow not being a real academic to do this. But I think the landscape has changed somewhat, and I got to keep reminding myself that certainly in the UK, I'm a public servant. I'm paid for by the taxes. And, you know, I have a duty to, you know, I'm paid for by other people's tax money. So I feel I've got a duty to try and communicate information which I feel is of relevance to them. And clearly there are situations where there's not enough communication happening. And science is under threat as well. I don't know what it's like in this country, but certainly in the UK at the moment, we're facing terrible cuts. And so I feel there's a real role now for people who are willing to step into the limelight, who are willing to talk. And to give opinions, so long as they go too far beyond their areas of expertise. But just to try and open up those channels of communication, maybe encourage some youngsters listening in that, you know, these are cool things. Science is cool. Mm-hmm. And we need to get more kind of pop stars of science. You know, we've seen it in every other realm, in athletics and music. But why not science? You know, it can be absolutely absorbing and fascinating. So there are some great people out there doing it, and I think that we should just encourage it. So I'm much more comfortable with my position now. Mm-hmm. I still have the luxury of engaging in real research, and I do that, and I would hate to lose that entirely. But that's becoming, you know, less of a characteristic of what my day job is.
And how do you find that your colleagues in institution respond to that?
Well, surprisingly, they're very positive towards it. Well, not surprising. It's just the fact that the university system in the UK is changing somewhat. We're moving more towards the American system. So, you know, college fees are going to start increasing. And I think that we now have to compete with each other to get the best students, to raise our profiles, to become more corporate, if you mm-hmm. like. And that requires a degree in marketing. That requires academics getting out there, speaking, telling the kids about what we're doing, you know, getting the foreign students to come visit.
Right.
So these are all changes to the system. We've lost the nice, cozy, you know, insular kind of ivory tower image that was so common in the UK for many decades. We're now being forced by the change in economic circumstances to become more accountable, to become more corporate. And so what I do promotes the university.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the culture is still a little different in the United States. Mm. I think there isn't as much recognition of the need to popularize science or to communicate with the public
right.
or engage on a lot of issues. So maybe it's ironic, but I think there may be more of an ivory tower sort of attitude over here.
Yes. Well, of course, you know, the U.S., you're very familiar with paying large college fees, mm-hmm. and you've always had a system of, you know, setting up the college fee with the kids born and the mom, you know, grandparents feed the money into it. And this idea of paying for your education has been in your culture for many decades. Mm-hmm. But of course, in the UK, this has just recently come in because we always had a kind of social system which allowed for higher education. And what happened is that they've just increased the numbers of students going to university without any additional funding. And so this has now put a lot of pressure on the system to try and teach more students for less money. And we've now reached an impasse where, in fact, we now charge for our fees. And they've been moderate amounts, about $5,000 a year. But all the signs and indications show that that's going to increase. Mm-hmm. So, and this is what people are finding very difficult to accept because, you know, they've had it for so many decades where they don't
right.
pay for their education. But, you know, I think that, you know, a college education, a university education, as we say, you know, opens up so many doors, gives you better job opportunities, better salaries, and therefore it has to be paid for. I would prefer that, you know, we did have a social system which allowed everybody to go, but we've tried that and it seems to be failing very badly. The government is just not giving us the support.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's not that they're not paying for it. They are paying for it through taxes.
Taxes.
Like VAT taxes and these sorts of things.
That's true. That is true. It's just that that doesn't immediately feed back to the university systems. It goes into the economy.
Yes, right.
I think the expenditure on science in the UK is something like 0.04% of the GDP, which is pretty pathetic.
Right.
Are there like lobby groups or something that get together and try to get larger percentages?
No, is the simple answer to that. We do have some individuals who are trying to draw the public's attention to it. Brian Cox, for example, is a very popular young physicist, very, very successful. And he's been very vocal about this, especially with the cancellation of many departments. You know, we're losing chemistry departments right across British universities because they're too expensive to run. But we've just had a change in government, and I don't know if your listeners are aware, but we have a huge deficit in our budget, and so they're operating draconian kind of cuts, a quarter, 25% of cuts right across the board from the public sector. So that means, you know, huge pressure on us to try and find other sources of money. So it's difficult.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're certainly running huge deficits over here, but so far they're not cutting anything. They're just sort of
It's been interesting. I think what you guys are doing right, because you're stimulating it by, you know, because basically economies grow out of innovations.
Yeah.
And I think that you can't cut off your lifeblood,
right?
Because the long term consequences of not supporting higher education is that you create this huge gap. Mm-hmm. Because who are you going to fill it with if you don't have the youngsters being trained up with degrees and that? So it's really important not to kill off your lifeblood.
Yeah, it's the difference between investing and spending.
Exactly.
Right. And higher education is an investment.
I think so.
Yeah, especially in I do think that in this country there's been a recognition of so-called STEM, you know, education, which is the science, technology, engineering. And I think it seems that that came out of the Cold War. Continues to a lesser degree even till today, although as the more threatened we feel, the more we sort of go back to, oh, we got to be competing in science and engineering.
Well, wars are very good for stimulating technology.
That's true.
Yeah.
That is true.
They are true, yeah.
And it's true in the
But I don't get me wrong. I'm not saying let's go to war again.
Right.
No, no, no.
But no, it's just a historical fact.
Yeah, it focuses the attention of the politicians, you know. But unfortunately, they're not really that sympathetic to science otherwise. In our country, very few of our politicians have a science background. Mm-hmm. So they don't respond to
Same here.
Yeah.
Same
so,
here.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, so what kind of science versus pseudoscience conflicts are common over in the UK? And you've traveled back and forth between the UK and the US enough. Do you have a sense of like what the similarities and differences are?
Well, obviously in your country, religion is one of the big controversies and the extent of the religious right and the power they wield. We have a bit of a problem in the UK, but nowhere near as much. And that's simply because we don't have as many extreme religious people in control. Although they do seem to be on the increase again. So you have to be kind of, I'm not going to pass comment on that, but you know, it is not such an issue in this country, in the UK. Where we have problems are basically issues on alternative therapies.
Mm-hmm.
Homeopathy is something which gets up a lot of people's noses. I actually controversially don't feel so, you know, upset by it, which really annoys my fellow skeptics because they think we shouldn't tolerate anything, which is basically peddling water as a cure. But I happen to have a belief in the placebo effect. And so I think we have to really question, and I'm not saying there's a simple answer here, by the way, whether or not we should allow people to pay for water if they think it makes them get better and they're not a drain on, you know, public money.
Mm-hmm.
I can see a good argument for that, actually, if they're not sort of cluttering up the diagnostic expense bills. Because, you know, otherwise they want to be sent off for scans and they want to be sent off and have every other thing done. So I actually if people are happy to pay for that, that's fine.
Well, is that science though? I mean, how does that fit in?
Well, the placebo effect is very real.
Well, yes.
Okay. But it depends on what you're talking about though. Mm. It's interesting that you say that because Ben Goldacre has a very similar opinion. I don't know if you're familiar with that. And I don't know if that's because you're both from the UK or if it's just
Ben and I do actually agree on this. And actually, so is, you know, Richard Wiseman has said something very similar as well. And that's actually, a lot of people have got very upset by that because the 1023 campaign has been very successful. And it seems very likely that public support for the homeopathic hospitals, there are five of them in the UK, is going to be cut.
Mm-hmm.
And that sounds like a great success. But that actually, in terms of pounds, is £4 million for the entire program. A series of investigations for neurological conditions, fMRI scanning, all that, pales in comparison to the costs. So I think that, and I have to be careful here because I know the cases, and they're very distressing cases where people have deliberately or, you know, gone to seek out alternative therapy and not you know, engaged in conventional therapy, especially with kids.
Right.
So we have cases around the world where people have died
right.
because of their belief in homeopathy. And so I'm not saying that I'm an apologist for it. I'm just a realist in terms of maybe there is scope for people who want to do that, so long as they're not denying access to conventional medicine. So mm-hmm. it's a difficult area, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I think where I would disagree with, I mean, I've heard Ben Goldacre articulate the issue. So,
yeah.
you know, I'm not aware of, I've never had this conversation with Richard Wiseman, but it's, I think Ben overestimates the effect of the placebo effect.
And really? Right.
It's been, I mean, I've written about it, I've reviewed the literature on the placebo effect, and it's pretty clear, actually, that there isn't really much of a placebo effect.
Really?
That it's,
wow.
Yeah, it's really limited to subjective complaints.
Right, of course.
Yeah, so, yeah. Okay. But if you ask the question, is there any measurable biological effect that can be attributed to placebo effects, the answer is a pretty clear no.
Okay.
So you have to put that into context. The other argument that my colleagues and I make is that, well, whatever psychological benefit or nonspecific benefit you get from placebo effects, which are essentially nonspecific therapeutic effects, you get them from real treatments too.
Yeah.
And so it's not like homeopathy or whatever can provide something that getting some minimalist but rational and science-based treatment can also deliver.
Right.
And then there's the harm of homeopathy, which even if you buy the notion, and I think 99% of the stuff that's sold as homeopathy is completely inert, and therefore there's no direct harm. The indirect harm is kind of hard to quantify.
Yeah, I agree.
And so I'm not so complacent about saying that there isn't much of an indirect harm from legitimizing and peddling really abject nonsense as if it were medicine.
But this is the beauty of skepticism. I mean, this the point is that, you know, if we're not dogmatic, and we can take apart these arguments and consider all the factors which are feeding into it. It's news to me that what you're telling me about the size of the effect of placebo. I'm not an expert in it,
right.
but I think as skeptics, we're allowed to sit down and say, okay, let's evaluate the evidence.
Yes,
let's
absolutely.
Look at the budgets. Let's do the analysis. And I think that, you know, Phil Platt made an issue yesterday about skepticism should try and be a little bit, not more tolerant, but just kind of stop being so dogmatic or categorical that there's a right and wrong to every issue. Because very, very rarely is that the case.
Right.
And so maybe what I'm saying is that let's look at all the costs and benefits of that. The issue about homeopathy is whether it's effective. Well, everyone knows it's water.
Yeah, I mean, it's not effective. That we could agree
on that.
We
can all agree on that. It's the other issue about whether or not allowing people to pay for water is either morally right, ethically right. You know, these are the complex issues.
Absolutely, and they're definitely issues that we don't take for granted. And that's probably one of the most frequent questions I get as a skeptical physician is, well, if this treatment is benign and comes with a placebo effect and it makes people feel better,
what's the harm?
You know, then not only what's the harm, but isn't there some benefit to that? And that's a very important question. And there's many sub questions in there, like how can we optimize the beneficial aspects of placebo effects within the framework of not lying to patients? You know?
Yeah. So, well, that of course is the Hippocratic oath is it has to be maintained. You're absolutely right.
So. Yeah, so I mean, I acknowledge all the complexities, and I do think it's a great conversation to have. But I'll just say that we've been having that conversation, and I like to think that we have developed a nuanced opinion about it. But I've recently become aware of the fact that there's sort of a different sort of opinion developing in my UK colleagues, which interests me, which is why I wanted to explore it a little bit.
Let's consider some future scenarios.
Yeah.
Let's say, okay, so we ban homeopathy, or let's say we cut funding. For
which is the more,
That's more
banning
likely. Banning it is never going to work.
Right. It's like prohibition.
We know that the same people who seek out a lot of this are generally chronic patients. You know, this is usually why they've quite often it's testimony hearing from someone else, but very often it's people who have not responded. We then have to say, well, what replaces it? Because I think that some people are inclined towards this way of thinking. And so, you know, in many ways, water is just water. But then when you start getting into all the other stuff, then this, I mean, for example, Chinese alternative therapies, that's really worrisome. Because
definitely a lot more worse things.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So,
and whenever people start to say that, well, you know, if there's this huge population of people with chronic symptoms, and this notion that if we service their chronic complaints with benign, inexpensive, and simple treatments that make them feel better, this puts a tremendous relief on the system because we can't, you know, send them off for MRIs and complicated workups. I understand that, but that was the Barefoot Doctor campaign that Mao Zedong underwent, where we can't afford to give scientific medicine to a billion people, so we're going to have this sort of army of barefoot doctors who are going to give them the traditional stuff that we know doesn't work, but who cares? It's cheap and they can do it. And it kind of rubs me a little bit the wrong way, but I understand the dilemma there that, and I do think this is exactly the problem that America is having, is that we have the technology to and the science to provide more healthcare than we can afford. I think this is a very important question that needs to be addressed. I'm not willing to say let's just give them sugar pills and make them go away so we don't have to pay for them. I think I'm not saying that was your position, but I'm saying that is kind of sort of where it can lead to. I think rather we need to figure out as a profession how to efficiently deal with these people within a more reasonable science-based and ethical framework. And maybe there are lots of lessons to be learned from these alternative practitioners who have found a way to sort of optimize the more what I call touchy-feely aspects of medicine. So maybe we don't need physicians doing the million-dollar workup on everybody who has these chronic complaints, and maybe we can have allied professionals like nurse practitioners or whatever that are able to approach these problems in a way that is more minimalist. And again, there's a lot of complexities here. I think though that we get off on a very ultimately destructive tangent if we say that these non-scientific modalities have a useful role to play directly in dealing with that issue. But I don't have the ultimate solution either, because I understand that we're in the process of going bankrupt paying for the medicine that we have the technology to deliver. It's like we're victims of our own success. Now what do we do?
Yeah.
You know, it's tough.
Indeed.
I don't have a solution, but I admire the problem.
Right.
But at least we can talk about it. And that's
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, Bruce, for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Thank you, Bruce. Okay.
Cheers, bye.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. And I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Is everybody ready?
Yes. Si, senor.
Great. Bob's up 2-0 against Jay. We got two more weeks left in the August challenge.
Or the August challenge.
It's very exciting.
Yes. So here we go.
It's not exciting.
It is. Item number one. A new analysis confirms that the so-called mitochondrial Eve lived about 200,000 years ago. Item number two. New research indicates that for adults, internet access at home is significantly associated with a decreased probability of being involved in a romantic relationship. And item number three. New images of the moon's surface indicate that the moon is shrinking by about 100 meters in the recent past. Bob, go first.
So we got the mitochondrial Eve 200,000 years ago. That's my memory of that. That kind of coincides with my memory of when they believed mitochondrial Eve existed. I don't know if they just kind of pinned it down a little more closely than they had years ago when that news came out, but that seems about right to me. And then for the second one, internet access at home decreased probability of being involved in a romantic relationship. Let me think about that one. The third one, the moon's surface shrinking by about 100 meters in the recent past. Recent past, of course, kind of vague. So I assume you mean that it's 100 meters closer to the core than it used to be. Yeah, I could see some funky geological something going on that could do that. I mean, really, it's not 100 meters, 300 feet. Well, that's interesting. The second one, though, I think I've got a problem with the second one here. If you've got internet access at home, it's associated with a decreased probability of being involved. I would think that being connected with all the social media and everything would have the opposite effect of just communicating with anybody on the planet. So that one doesn't quite make sense to me. I'm going to say that one is fiction.
Okay, Jay.
A new analysis confirms that the so-called mitochondrial Eve lived about 200,000 years ago. That makes a lot of sense, and I agree with that one. New research indicates that for adults, internet access at home is significantly associated with a decreased probability of being involved in a romantic relationship. That one's the fake.
Would you like to comment on the third one?
The surface of the moon shrinking by about the size of a football field. I wouldn't say the recent past. I'd say that that happened. What do you consider the recent past? You have to define that. But that is in fact true. It's just not recent. It's been happening for, you know, since the moon was created. That process started.
Okay, whatever that means.
Well, what's the define recent past, Steve?
All right, I'll say this: the geologically recent past.
Ah, I see. Mm. Ah. Yeah. Number two is the fake.
How does that sound?
All right, Evan.
The first one was the analysis confirming so-called mitochondrial Eve living about 200,000 years ago. Yeah, new analysis. Sure, learning all kinds of new stuff about mitochondrial Eve. Didn't we speak about mitochondrial Eve in the episode
several
two
times.
Months ago?
In the recent past.
in the geologic past. Yeah, I'm not at all surprised at that. I'll jump to number three. New images of the moon's surface indicate the moon is shrinking. So they're able to determine that just from the images of the moon's surface. It's fascinating. I wonder exactly how they're able to determine that. And all that is left is this research about adults' internet access at home. Decreased probability of being involved in a romantic relationship. I'll go with the flow and say that that one is fiction.
Okay, Rebecca?
Yeah, I hate to be boring, but I just want to say that you laughed at Jay, but I agree with him. I think by about 100 meters in the recent past that clause makes no sense to me. I think Jay is right, and I don't think that it's even quite correct saying recent past geologically, because I think this is something that's been happening over billions of years. So, I mean, I wouldn't call billions of years recent by even geologic standpoint. So, but I'm not a geologist, so I think that basically what you're saying in that is true. However, the idea that increased internet access decreases the probability of being involved in a romantic relationship, I think that's just obviously false, because never before have we had such a powerful tool for allowing socially inept people to find one another and get laid.
Hey.
So.
Well said.
Okay. I agree. Yeah.
So let's start with number one. A new analysis confirms that the so-called mitochondrial Eve lived about 200,000 years ago. You all think that one is science, and that one is science.
Science.
Oh, that pause. Oh, that pause every week.
Yes. And this is a confirmation of what was previously believed. It was confirmation, nothing new. But what researchers did was a new analysis looking at the distribution of mutations in mitochondrial DNA for various populations throughout the Earth. And they did different kinds of analysis. And the interesting thing is that by the few different ways they look at it, at the data, it all still is coming up with about the 200,000-year-old age, which is very reassuring. And then they discuss the fact that there's a lot of assumptions in the way the genetics are analyzed, you know, in terms of how likely it is for any one person on the planet to mate with any other person on the planet and the change of the population over time, et cetera. So what they did was said, well, if we vary these, you know, variables, how much does that affect our calculations? And they found that it actually doesn't affect it very much at all. So even though they're making a lot of assumptions and guesses in doing their calculations, if they plug in different values, the analysis still is coming in around the 200,000-year-old mark. So that seems to be an increasingly reliable figure. And again, for background, the mitochondrial Eve is essentially the most recent female that all humans share as a common ancestor. It doesn't mean that that was the only female common ancestor. And mitochondrial DNA, which is extranuclear, is only passed down through the female line. And it's possible for mitochondrial lines to be lost, right? So if you had a small population of a couple thousand individuals, it's possible that just, you know, all the mitochondrial lines eventually died out except for this one that then ended up, you know, dominating and then, you know, being the sole remaining mitochondrial line that all humans have. But again, it doesn't mean that we don't have nuclear DNA from other females at that time. So it's not a literal Eve, not a literal single female ancestor.
Was this the last population bottleneck, as they
Steve? It was probably the most recent population bottleneck shared by all of humanity, yes.
Yeah.
Let's go on to number two. New research indicates that for adults, internet access at home is significantly associated with a decreased probability of being involved in a romantic relationship. You guys all thought that this one was the fiction, and this one is the fiction. You guys all got it right?
Yay.
Yep.
The research actually showed the exact opposite, that it increases the risk of being involved in a romantic relationship. But the researchers said that they went into this study thinking that the opposite may be the true, may be true. The concern is that people who spend a lot of time on the internet or playing games, etc., may actually have decreased social interactions. But you guys are right that it actually the internet access facilitates hooking up, you know, making romantic connections. And that's what the research showed.
Sadly, yes, that's true.
Yes.
Sadly.
I lost.
Once you picked the same one that Bob did, you had no chance of winning.
There was no way I had to. Look,
you did the right thing. You picked the right answer.
Yeah. Something happened tonight that has never happened before.
What?
I absolutely read all three of these news items and remembered them, and instantly, as soon as I saw them...
You knew what the right answer was.
I knew what the right answer was. So I was betting on Bob not hitting.
Well, just before we did the show, and when it was way too late for me to pick a new item, I discovered that Phil Plate tweeted number three. I don't know if any of you guys saw his tweet.
I read it earlier. No, I didn't read his tweet. Item? I mean, I read the article. I think it was on IO9 or something.
New images of the moon's surface indicate that the moon is shrinking by about 100 meters in the recent past. That is science. And, I know recent's vague because they don't know how long ago it was. But it could be as recent as 100 million years, which is geologically recent, given that the moon's several billion years old.
I thought it was just getting denser, but, you know, through its own gravity.
Well, it's probably because of the core cooling is what they think. So it's not losing mass; it is condensing. Yeah, but it's probably because the core is cooling. And this is based upon these geological formations called lobate scarps, which are like cliffs, and they can estimate how old they are, and they know that as far as lunar geology goes, they're recent features. They're about 300 feet high, and they think that could indicate that the moon's surface has shrunk by about 300 feet or 100 meters. So there you go. This is based upon images from the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter.
Well, congratulations, Bob.
Yeah, thank you, Jay.
Congratulations, Bob. You have officially won the contest.
Was there any doubt?
That means we need to settle on something.
Yeah, so next week I will announce what the punishment is.
Oh, you haven't decided yet?
No, I still have one.
Wait. You can't decide after you know who's got to do
it. Guess what?
It's too late. It's too late because I haven't decided yet, and I know who's won. So
what?
Unless you got a time machine, there's no other option.
No, I think this scuttles the whole thing. I mean,
nope.
Scuttles the whole thing.
Jay, just face it. You fell victim to regression to the mean. You got a little cocky there because you got a couple answers in a row correct, and Bob didn't.
Cocky, yep. Nothing. I thought I was gonna study hard like I was trying to answer these questions, and
the hot hand fellas
legitimately beat me. I will take my punishment.
Okay,
I will do it. But I expect to hear what my punishment is. I want to hear what
next week.
All right.
Because I was planning on doing it for the end of the month, and I didn't account for the fact that Bob could win in 3 weeks. Didn't even go the distance, Jay.
Yeah, baby.
Not having the Stanley Cup ready when one team has won a whole bunch of games in the fourth game. Oh, well.
Well, Jay,
yeah.
Do you have a quote for us this week?
I have a quote. This is a quote sent in by David Inwood. And it was the quote is from a textbook written by Martin S. Silberberg. It's a long one, so get ready. You know that chemistry has an impact on your daily life, but the extent of the impact can be mind-boggling. Consider just the beginning of a typical day from a chemical point of view. Molecules align in the liquid crystal display of your clock. Electrons flow through its circuitry to create a rousing sound, and you throw off a thermal insulator of manufactured polymer. You jump in the shower to emulsify fatty substances on your skin and hair with chemically treated water and formulated detergents. You adorn yourself in an array of processed chemicals. Pleasant-smelling, pigmented materials suspended in cosmetic gels, dyed polymeric fibers, synthetic footwear, and metal alloy jewelry. Today, Breakfast is a bowl of nutrient-enriched, spoilage-retarded cereal and milk, a piece of fertilizer-grown, pesticide-treated fruit, and a cup of a hot, aqueous solution of neurally stimulating alkaloid. Ready to leave, you collect some books, processed cellulose and plastic electrically printed with light and oxygen-resistant inks, hop in your hydrocarbon-fueled metal vinyl ceramic vehicle, electrically ignite a synchronized series of controlled gaseous explosions, and you're off to class. How cool is that quote? Written by Martin S. Silverberg. Come on, that was really cool.
It was fun. It's a bit trivially true in that it's basically saying, yes, stuff is made of chemicals. But it is, I have commented before that chemistry and the technology of material science and synthesizing chemicals are responsible for our modern society in a huge way that is grossly underappreciated by the average person.
Yeah, this quote I think is interesting because as that person moves through the first, 30 to 40 minutes of their day, getting out of bed, getting in the shower, getting out the door, all of this stuff, it's just everywhere. Everything.
Yeah.
These are all man-made, I wouldn't say man-made chemicals, but man-made things using chemistry. Everything is based off of chemistry. Everything is based off of chemistry.
I have an announcement. I wanted to mention that there's a very exciting development that the Skeptics have organized for Dragon Con this year. We're going to be doing a free whooping cough vaccine clinic. Right now, whooping cough, or pertussis as it's known, is an epidemic in California with, almost 3,000 cases reported so far this year. It's 8 times last year's number. And I think 8 infants have died already. And Dragon Con is packed full of the sort of people who should be getting their booster shots. They're about the right age for it. Because you get vaccinated when you're younger, but it wears off after a few years. So unfortunately,
4 to 20.
Unfortunately, a lot of adults are walking around unvaccinated, and they can pass whooping cough along to infants who are too young to be vaccinated, and it's deadly. So, if you are going to Dragon Con, you can find our free clinic on Saturday and Sunday, from 10 a.m. on, I believe, doing free vaccines. It's going to be in the mall at Peachtree Center, which is connected to the Dragon Con main hotels by footbridge. It's right by the food court, and we're going to have a giant space available to vaccinate as many people as we can. So stop by.
Now,
it's free.
Rebecca, are you going to be giving the vaccines yourself?
Legally, I am unable to actually stab people myself, but
you'll give them a cookie.
I'll be there to hug people, because it also marks the launch of the campaign Hug Me, I'm Vaccinated. So we'll be giving away free Surly Ramek necklaces that say Hug Me, I'm Vaccinated, and there'll be discounts for Surly Ramek's products and things like that. So yeah, please stop by and get your vaccination.
That's awesome, Rebecca. I wish I was going to
be there.
Yeah,
it's good work.
Well done.
That is
really
cool.
It is
really exciting. And I should mention that it's Maria and Elise, my two skeptic buddies that have been doing the bulk of the work on this. And they've done a really wonderful job.
Take pictures and everything. I want to see how it goes.
We will. We're hoping to get plenty of pictures of Klingons being vaccinated and things like that. If you show up in costume, you're more likely to get prizes.
And you'll get more enthusiastic hugging.
Yes.
That's surprises.
Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Well, thank you, Steve.
You're welcome, Steve. You suck,
well
Bob.
Well done. Well
Good
done.
Times.
Congratulations, Bob. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and skeptchick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.